Hey there, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Home Class Movie Chat. We are so excited for you to be here
Hey,
today.
hun,
Yes? What?
what about the intro music?
I forgot about that. Here comes the music.
Everybody, welcome back to the Home Class Movie Chat. We are your hosts, movie fans, Kat
And Paul.
And we just love to talk about movies.
We certainly do. We love to talk about movies, except this one.
Well, you know, you got to do the bad along with the good.
I'm sorry. I just don't see.
I got to tell you, my final piece of trivia for tonight is going to really blow your mind at the end of the podcast.
Oh, seriously?
It's honestly worth sticking around through this to hear that last piece of trivia. It's really worth it.
Well, what movie are we doing today?
We are doing Hereditary.
Now, I have heard people rave upon rave upon rave about this movie.
And
now, my first thought was, okay, I'm intrigued enough to watch this. I watched this for the second time.
Oh, I didn't realize you'd seen it before.
Yeah. I just wanted to make sure that I'd actually seen the right movie. And I still don't think I've seen the right one.
Okay, so I adore Toni Collette and Gabriel Byrne, who are both in this.
Yeah.
And they play husband and wife. And this is by far the worst film that I have seen associated with either of them. When we were first talking about doing this on the podcast, my reaction was, okay, Hereditary, Toni Collette, Gabriel Byrne, directed by Ari Aster, his directorial debut. Don't bother. It's boring as batshit. It doesn't make any sense. Don't waste your time. End of podcast.
Pretty much so. He was Gabriel Byrne was so underutilized. He is a magnificent actor.
Yeah.
And literally, you don't see him.
No.
And the times you do,
he's just milquetoast.
Yeah. Now, I've seen this movie, and I will say, categorically, it is the most disappointing, boring as batshit, garbage fest as a horror movie that I've ever seen in my life. And
I had a couple of jump scares, but you saw them coming a mile away.
I have seen so many horror movies. I mean, I will even put it up there with goddamn Birdemic. Birdemic actually
Stop
had
more language, mister. This is a family-friendly podcast.
No, it's going to another podcast. I'm allowed to swear. Birdemic was actually more fun to watch, and that was garbage and a half.
Oh, yeah.
Compared to this piece of garbage.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I would actually say that this was worse than Birdemic, and that's saying something.
Yeah, now I am so disappointed that...
I mean, at least Birdemic and things like Plan 9 from Outer Space
Plan
were
9,
so
I loved it.
Bad.
Yeah.
That they are kind of awesome in their own way. This was just plain bad.
I've seen Plan 9 from Outer Space at least half a dozen times, and I am actually liking it every time I see it. I have watched this pile of dog doo doo 2 times in a row.
Sorry, Ari, but it was just plain bad.
It was horrible. I'm sorry. And I know I've seen Hereditary. I know I've seen the movie that people are raving about. But if I hear one more podcast to say this is the greatest movie ever, I want to go onto their show and say, excuse me, what was so amazing about this movie?
Well, I find it interesting because director Ari Aster wanted to make a film about suffering that took suffering seriously, but I didn't realize that he wanted the audience to suffer along with it.
He has made me suffer. He has taken away. Now,
the one
there
thing
are so many things about this movie I can say, and they're all going to be bad.
Now,
they're
the
all
one
going to
thing,
be bad.
The one thing that I can say, didn't I say to you that it looked like Utah?
It did. Yeah.
That's
you
where
said
they
that.
Filmed it, Park City, Utah.
Really?
Yeah. He liked it because of the mountains, because they're beautiful and breathtaking, but also menacing and ominous. Ooh.
Just too bad he didn't do a menacing and ominous movie.
I know, right?
Now, this movie went for 127 minutes, and I'm telling you,
I want my life back.
I want my life back. I'm sorry. I want this back because this is garbage. And the 127 minutes, you are dragged through this mindless, tedious, boring ass movie. Now, I looked at the budget, right? The budget of this movie was $10 million and it made $82.8 million at the box office. I know you people went to see this movie, but how did you get $82.8 million out of this trash?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I even went as far, and I don't like to go really into Rotten Tomato, but I needed to go into Rotten Tomato just to see.
I want
to
know what the score, Rotten Tomato score was.
Okay. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. This is out of 100%. On the tomato meter, it is 90%. An audience score of a 10,000 plus ratings, 70% out of 100.
You have, how?
Exactly.
Was it like a mass hypnosis or did they like pump drugs into the air or something?
Everyone that walked into that cinema must have been told, listen, you're going to go to see and you don't know about it because suddenly you're being given some sort of hallucinogens to say this is a great movie.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. This movie is by far, I don't like to
trash movies, but no. There was just nothing good about this. I mean, Toni Collette was brilliant, as always.
Yeah, she was good. I mean, certainly her portrayal of absolute despair and when she was crying, you could feel,
you could feel
it was really genuine. Like she was pulling from somewhere very, very deep.
Yeah, well, what I find fascinating is that Toni Collette had told her agent that she didn't want to do any more heavy or dark films and only wanted to do comedies because she really shines in the comedies.
Yeah, she does.
But she loved the Hereditary script so much she couldn't turn it down. I just don't get it. But she actually doesn't like horror films, which is what made her hesitant at first to act in Hereditary. But the only reason she accepted her roles in Fright Night and Krampus were because she saw them more as black comedies than horror films.
Well, the remake of the original Fright Night was, I mean, I've seen it. It's like, yeah.
Yeah. Now, Ari Aster put so much love into this film. I will give him that. He actually wrote, did you know, he actually wrote detailed biographies and backstories for all of the characters before he even wrote the screenplay?
No, I didn't because he didn't show any of it.
Yeah. And he was inspired by family dramas such as Ordinary People from 1980, which is actually a brilliant film and was Robert Redford's directorial debut.
Okay. Yep.
The Ice Storm in 1997, In the Bedroom from 2001, as it is by classic horror films such as Rosemary's Baby from 1968, Don't Look Now in 1973, and The Innocents from 1961.
Okay, so he's certainly drawing on a lot, but I even said to you that a lot of the cinematography that he does, I would say, is heavily pulled from Quentin Tarantino's movies.
Yeah, and what was it we were watching?
Kill Bill.
Oh, Kill Bill. Yeah. And I could see the influence.
You can see it.
Yeah.
That at some stage, he went to Tarantino's movies and sat and watched it and went, you know what? I can take that. And it shows so much so in the beginning of the movie.
It's almost like a stealing from it.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is. And if anyone doesn't understand that, look at Kill Bill, the way it's shot, and look at the opening part of this movie and even subsequent parts of this movie, and you'll see that there is a direct influence from Quentin Tarantino's movies.
Yeah,
and
it's Tarantino, like he went to the Quentin Tarantino School of Film.
Yeah, Tarantino is an amazing movie producer, and his visions are absolutely outstanding. So this guy must have looked at those movies. Someone must have actually pointed him in the direction of Tarantino and said, watch these movies. Things like Jackie Brown, things like, Kill Bill and others that he has done, and said, look at exactly what he does and incorporate that into your movie.
Well, and that's the thing is it, instead of finding his own way through this, and I get he's a first-time director, but it's like, you know, don't, and it's like, well, what Quentin Tarantino does obviously works. It obviously sells. So therefore, if I do it too, my movie will work and sell. And it just doesn't work that way.
I mean, he made $82.8 million on
yeah, he did something right
at the box office. That's fine. But I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that you just announced two people, Gabrielle Byrne and Toni Collette. Those
yeah,
two powerhouses.
Huge draws.
But the problem is, and I said to you before, they misused Gabrielle Byrne. He was not even in the movie.
Yeah.
Very
he was
much
hardly
at all.
There at all.
And even when he was there, there was no chemistry between him and Toni Collette. There was
none
nothing.
Whatsoever.
You couldn't feel any of it. It wasn't a family dynamic. Even at the point where she is absolutely weeping and absolutely is a broken woman on the ground crying at a scene that we're going to get to, he was almost just sitting there going, yeah, they're there.
Yeah.
She,
Yeah.
You know, it just didn't work for me. I didn't actually believe it.
Yeah. Now, what I will give him credit that Ari Aster wanted any effect that could be done practically to be done that way rather than digitally in post-production.
Yeah.
So I'll give him credit for that. He also wanted to go for scares that were emotionally justified rather than solely leaning on the traditional horror jump scares. So I'll give him A for that.
Okay. I mean, certainly, as far as I could see, there was nothing scary whatsoever. There was a confronting scene that you will see, and I even actually got
yeah,
Kat
we'll get
to turn
that.
Away for that, because that was a little bit too confronting for her. She's not a horror aficionado. She hasn't been.
I am not a gore fan.
No, whereas I am, and I can handle pretty much everything.
Yeah.
So the scene that we will get to, I said to Kat, and I knew it was coming because I'd seen the movie before, you know, close your eyes, turn away, do not watch this scene because it is extremely confronting. But that being said, that was not a horrifying thing. It was just a very confronting, jarring.
It was just horrific.
Yeah. But outside of that, there was just nothing about it. I mean, now, I listened to a podcast and they were saying that it was the best movie they've ever seen. And there's this scene and that scene. And I went to, and I watched the movie and I'm like, so what movie did you guys watch?
Yeah. What did you guys watch?
What did you see? Because I didn't see this.
Yeah. Now, Toni Collette, interestingly, has called Ari Aster the most prepared director she's ever worked with. She praised him for practically having the full movie already shot and edited in his head 2 years before they even started filming.
Yeah, maybe he should have started it earlier rather than wait 2 years.
Yeah, I don't know. But it was interesting, pardon me, that Ari Aster requested that Alex Wolff, who played Peter, and Millie Shapiro, who played his sister Charlie, go out to eat in character a few times, and they would sit there for up to 3 hours in silence while Millie wouldn't speak and Alex would try to get her to talk. And
The children were very weak.
And Alex decided to go method on this and would only let people call him Peter on the set.
Yep.
And was in character the entire time he was on the set. And it wasn't until after it wrapped that he introduced himself to the crew as Alex.
Yeah. I even found the children very weak actors. They were not standouts.
Charlie, especially. Peter had a few decent moments, but Charlie.
Peter really wasn't. It wasn't the entire movie. I didn't believe
the whole movie was weak.
Yeah. Now, look, before we get started really tearing this movie a new one, which we are going to do, we have to listen to the trailer. So sit back and relax, because here is the trailer to Hereditary.
Come on, Peter. Here's your suit.
It's heartening to see so many strange new faces here today. I know my mom would be very touched and probably a little suspicious. My mother was a very secretive and private woman. It's Grandma. You know you were her favorite, right? Even when you were a little baby, she wouldn't let me feed you because she needed to feed you. She was a very difficult woman, which maybe explains me.
I recognize you from your mother.
What? Sometimes I swear I can feel them in the room.
Oh my God! What was that?
She isn't gone. She had private rituals, private friends.
who's going to take care of me?
You don't think I'm going to take care of you?
But when you die.
She wasn't altogether there. At the end.
Mom? I don't like this. Dad, I don't like this.
What's happening?
Peter!
Don't you ever raise your voice at me. I am your mother.
Mom, what's happening?
I just don't want to put any more stress on my family.
Now, before we jump into it, I want to talk for a moment about that trailer.
Yeah.
Well, one of the trailers for Hereditary was accidentally shown at the beginning of a PG-rated family-friendly film called Peter Rabbit in Innaloo, Western Australia. It caused a small panic in the theater, with parents fleeing the cinema with their kids, and the theater eventually had to shut the screen off, the film off, and offered every audience member a complimentary movie pass to apologize.
Now, I have to apologize. Last week when we were doing The Nun, I did say that there was a trailer that came on that. I misspoke. I got it flipped around. I knew there was one of the movies that had been played in a PG-rated movie. That this is the one, not The Nun. I apologize for saying that The Nun actually was done. I know there are a lot of you that are sitting there were yelling at me last week going, that wasn't true. And now you're sitting there going, see, we told you, Paul. Well, yes, I am eating humble pie. I'm sorry, I misspoke. I knew there was one that certainly was played in the wrong part of a movie, and you don't show that on a PG-rated movie. So, but can you imagine it's a very confronting trailer, and that's the whole thing. Like, the trailer makes it look like it's going to be a great movie, but then you've got to sit through the garbage to get through to the end of the garbage, because there's nothing even remotely interesting about this movie. I mean, Kat and I have just recently seen the sequel to Avatar, which is Avatar The Way of Water, and I'm telling you, you can knock out about 45 minutes out of that movie with this incredible amount of padding in the center of the movie. Like, we were watching this because we were so excited about seeing Avatar. And at the end of it, I'm like, well, you could take out that part. You could take out that part. That was rubbish. That had no idea about. Why do they include that one? And really, that was a very disappointing movie. So this one is in itself extremely disappointing. Mm-hmm. And I've got nothing really positive to say about Hereditary. I don't know what every other people have seen. And if you guys are saying it's a great movie, I'm not going to say any which way that you guys are wrong. You guys have
if they
your own
think
opinion.
It's great, that's yeah. awesome. We I just don't see it.
No, I have my opinion. You guys have your opinion. Yeah. I know for a fact, from my opinion, that I'm never going to get the 126 minutes of my life back because I sat down and watched this rubbish.
Yeah.
And or I
what
don't
we,
li-
what we consider rubbish.
Rubbish. Yeah. And I don't like to rip horror movies a new one because I love horror movies.
Yeah.
But this one
it's really gotta be pretty bad for him to say it's bad.
Oh. I mean, I have gone through an amazing amount of horror movies that are really, I mean,
well that's one of the catchphrases for his sister podcast, The Horror Crypt, where he says that I watch the horror movies that are so bad and review them so you don't have to watch them.
Yeah, I watch them so you don't have to.
Yeah.
This movie I've watched. You don't have to watch it.
Trust me, don't do it.
You won't get the 100. You won't get the 120.
It's not even campy and cult classic material. It's just boring.
It is. It really is boring.
And it doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, I was really disappointed at this movie.
Yeah.
And so the movie begins with the viewers looking out from a window into a workshop to a treehouse. And then, of course, it turns and zooms into the bedroom into a dollhouse that is in a workshop. And I do like this part of the movie because the cinematography is actually quite good because
probably the best scene of the film.
Because the camera is looking into a dollhouse and you're seeing it's a bedroom.
Well, you see
up.
Like all these dioramas and stuff and then it takes
someone
you inside
in
of one of them and then suddenly a real person comes out.
Yeah, the door opens up and we find that Steve, which is Gabriel Byrne's character, he's waking up his young son Peter and his 13-year-old daughter Charlie because they're going to go to their grandmother's funeral. And of course, then we see that Steve says to Peter, you know, I can't find Charlie. Did she come into your room at all last night? And he goes, no. Of course, then when Steve goes out, he finds that Charlie's been sleeping in the treehouse. Now, we don't know why.
Cold.
It's very cold. We don't know why she goes in there, but she goes in there.
Yeah.
This is the beginning of it.
Well,
we
Charlie's
know.
Weird anyway.
He is. She's a very weird, weird little girl. So Steve's wife, Annie, which is Toni Collette. Yeah, that noise. Do it again. No, it's not picking it up on the thing. It's not picking it up. It's a clicking noise that she's doing with her tongue.
It's basically where you put the tongue against the roof of your mouth, and then it kind of creates a suction and you pull it off and it makes a popping noise.
Yeah. Yeah, like that. That's what we hear all the time from Charlie. But Charlie's really weird. And of course, Steve's wife, Annie, which is Toni Collette, she's an artist who sculpts dioramas, and she's delivering
a little miniatures.
Yeah, really lovely little miniatures. But it starts to take a very dark turn, as we find out. And she's delivering a eulogy at her mother's funeral. And of course, Charlie is making the clicking noises while drawing a very strange sketch in her speech. And when Charlie goes to look at her grandmother, who's laying in the coffin, Charlie looks to the what is the feet part of the coffin, and there's this guy standing there smiling at her. We don't see that guy again. We have no reference and no idea who this person is that's staring at her, but we find that Charlie is drawing this picture of him.
Yeah.
And we're like, okay. And we see that a person comes up and like dabs something on the grandmother's lips and walks away. That's never addressed ever again.
Nope.
So once now we're into.
Now, there were a lot of things that were cut out of this film, which was mostly family dialogue.
I don't know
if any of it explains any of this
stuff. They must have cut a whole lot out because it doesn't make any sense.
No.
So Annie then that night goes to talk to Charlie about her grandmother's funeral. And Charlie claims that her grandmother always wished that Charlie was a boy. I don't think that her grandmother ever said that to Charlie, or we don't ever find that out.
Okay, so there's a support meeting, like a grief support group, where Annie, Toni Collette's character, recounts her brother's suicide when he was 16 and states that his suicide note blamed their mother, Ellen, for putting people inside him. Though Annie chalks this up to his schizophrenia, it could very well be that Ellen originally attempted to conjure the demon Paimon through her own son. His death and her failure to summon Paimon would then explain why Ellen put so much pressure on Annie to have children, and why Charlie stated early on in the film that her grandmother wished that she was a boy, because we do later find out that Paimon was inside of Charlie, which is where that clicking thing came from. That's a sign of Paimon.
But if she wished that she was a boy.
Well, because she needed a body, she ended up getting the demon into Charlie. And that's why at the end of the film, Peter becomes the vessel.
Okay. So if the grandmother was so, and I'm sorry, we're spoiling it, but we have to spoil this movie because this is part of the podcast.
Yeah. It's all over the place anyway. So it doesn't matter.
If Ellen is trying to summon Paimon into a child and wants it into a boy, why wouldn't she just put that straight into Peter to begin with?
Probably because Peter might have been too strong at that point or something. I don't know.
See, this is why it's confusing. It really
because they
is.
Don't really tell you. Because remember at the end, they said, well, we had the imperfect vessel, i.e. Charlie. Now we have the perfect one. Peter.
So what? See, okay, so this is why I'm confused about this movie. If they had the imperfect one and it's in Charlie, then why didn't they just decide? If they wanted a male, why didn't they just put it into Peter to begin with?
That's never explained.
I know. And this is the whole thing. I think they've cut too much out of this.
Yeah.
I think they've done too much out of this.
I am going to take a slight detour because I really like this. The production designer wanted to play with the idea of sacred geometry. And the triangle of Annie, Peter, and Charlie, the square introduces Steve's character, home and groundedness, circle, which is infinite, Genesis, and Ellen, all different shapes embedded within the design of the set. If you look closely, the second floor hallway has squares and triangles carved into it.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah.
Probably because I was trying to get an idea of what this movie was all about.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah, and as I said, Gabriel Byrne, being such an amazing actor, he was so underutilized in this movie. He was, I mean, they could have really just made this as she was a single parent. That would have
I
made
know.
more sense.
But that being said, the producer said that it worked out well that Gabriel Byrne and Alex Wolff had actually worked together previously in the HBO TV show In Treatment in 2008. They've actually joked that every 7 years they're going to play father and son. And Alex and Millie Shapiro, who plays Charlie, knew each other from school because they were in the on-set school. Because they're young, because it made Toni Collette the outsider, which mirrored Annie's character and feelings of alienation within her own family.
I mean, as I said, Gabriel Byrne and Toni Collette, they had no chemistry in this movie.
Yeah, I
So I don't
know.
know whether that was part of the way that the producer or the director wanted it to be, but there was no, I couldn't believe that they were actually would be married.
Well,
It
did you
didn't.
know that Toni Collette's actually 22 years younger than Gabriel Byrne?
No, I didn't, but
Yeah,
then
there was a significant age difference there.
yeah.
But also, amusingly, Toni Collette and Alex Wolff, who plays her son Peter, share a birthday of November 1st.
Really?
Yeah,
Okay.
I thought
That's
that was kind of
that's
fun.
actually really good because yeah, but I still don't buy the fact that Toni Collette and Gabriel Byrne were married in this movie. It doesn't resonate with me.
They really have
I
no chemistry
no.
whatsoever.
As I said, it would have been probably better if they had just made it that she lost her husband and now she's a single parent. It would
Yeah.
actually be I'd
It would
actually
have made
believe
more
that.
sense.
Yeah, but to make him a character in the movie who was
Well,
barely there.
except for the point where he becomes the sacrifice.
Yeah, which we're gonna get to.
Yeah, we're going to get to that.
So I love it when, there's Charlie trying to say that to Annie. She also wonders who will care for her now that her grandmother is dead. And I love it how Annie sort of like looks at her and goes,
I'm your
"Well,
mother.
I'm your mother. I will." And then she goes, "Well, yeah, but then who will look after me when you're dead?" That's the end of the scene.
Yeah.
We don't know what the answer is.
Well, not just that, but we don't know why she's thinking like this.
No, we don't. And the
And
scene
it
is.
suggests to something, a relationship with her and her grandmother relating to the cult,
Which is never
which is
explained.
never explained.
And this scene ends where Annie is looking through a memory book and actually sees a vision of her grandmother in this book, but she doesn't seem to really want to engage in what looking at the picture. She'd like you see her start to look and then she's like, yeah, no, I can't look at that. Now, some of that can be grief. I understand that, that you don't want to look at you maybe have such raw emotions, you don't want to look at the pictures.
I kind of get that
Yeah.
because my as we've said before on this podcast, my mother passed away a couple of months ago, and I changed my Facebook header to or my Facebook profile picture to a picture of me and my mom, and I had to actually change it because I just couldn't handle seeing it every time I logged into Facebook. So I changed it to one of you and me.
Now that is obviously that is a grief reaction, and the emotions are still raw, and over time it will get less to the point that you'll be able to look at pictures of your mother.
Yeah.
And I guess right now Annie can't look at the visions of her, but it's really never explained because Annie's got these boxes, which is mum or mom,
Well, because
but there are
she
boxes
was
in her
living,
workshop.
her mother was living with her. They were taking care of her, and she died in the house.
Yeah, but there is also some underlying really weird issues with regards to the dynamic of her mother and Annie with bringing up the children, which we find out later
Yeah.
through a
And
diorama that was very, very weird.
yeah, there was also, but I think if I remember correctly, when she was going through the photo album and she saw a picture of her grandmother, wasn't there something about her, the grandmother
There was
wearing
a necklace.
the medallion with this symbol on it?
So her great grandmother was wearing it. Then her mother was wearing the same medallion,
Yeah.
and there was a picture of all these women around her mother that were almost like worshiping her.
Yeah.
I remember there was a part of the there was a picture where her mother had her eyes closed, and there was these women like dropping like gold coins over her, and it was like a
Yeah.
photograph as it was being done. But that's never explained, and we
No.
don't know. why this was happening. And even to the end of the movie, we still don't know why. We've got no point of reference. Why were they worshipping her?
Yeah.
We got no idea. Now, this is a scene which this part of the scene doesn't make any sense either, because the next scene we see.
And the ironic part is it's supposed to be exposition. It's supposed to help us understand what's going on and why, but it actually just
confuses
things more than anything.
The editor must have edited too much out. That's all I can put it down to. Because this scene coming up is where Charlie is sitting in her classroom and she's off with the pixies, I guess, because she's not concentrating. She's drawing something, she's clicking, and she suddenly hears this bang against the window. And we see that there is a bird that's flying into the window, a pigeon that's flying in the window, right? So at the break, at lunch, at recess, whatever you want to call it, she goes out with a pair of scissors and
she swipes from the teacher's desk.
Yeah. And she cuts the bird's head off.
Which is gross.
Which is disgusting. And there's a woman across
the street. And puts it in her pocket.
I know. And then there's
Now what I want to know is, how is it that there wasn't a crap ton of blood showing on her sweater that made and the smell that would make teachers go, what is in your pocket?
Yeah. Now, she also has a propensity to eat chocolate bars, and she's got an anaphylactic reaction to peanuts.
Yeah, she's very deathly allergic to peanuts.
Yeah. So at one stage when we're in the funeral home, when her grandmother passed away, she pulled out a chocolate bar out of her pocket and started eating it. Her and her father was like, that doesn't have nuts in it. And even the mother says, it doesn't have nuts in it because we don't have the EpiPen. Now, I'm sorry, if your child has got a deathly allergic reaction.
You always carry an EpiPen.
Yeah. Yep. But she goes, oh, we didn't bring the EpiPen. Well, then, woman, you're in a deep.
You're a bad mom.
Yeah. Take your EpiPen.
Yeah.
But so we see her. She's just, I mean, and as I said, you know, there's Charlie with the severed bird's head in her pocket. She's eating a chocolate bar. And there's a woman across the street waving at Charlie. We don't see that woman again. We don't know who she is. And in this day and age, if there is a strange woman out there, out the gates of a school, waving at a child, you bet there's going to be police all over the place asking who the hell she is. And
she's telling him to get out.
I know.
Yeah. Now, while we're at school, in Peter's first scene at school, he's in class, and the words escaping fate is on the chalkboard with the teacher discussing it. This is actually a reference to Halloween, the 1978 film Halloween, where the main character discusses the same thing in class. Appropriately, this movie was released the same day as the trailer for Halloween 2018.
Now, we're talking about the original Halloween where she's in the classroom and she's talking about, oh, wow, okay.
Yeah. So it's an homage to the original Halloween of 1978.
That's
and
a nice
the movie was released on the same day as the trailer for Halloween 2018.
That's a nice little nugget.
Because there is
a scene where they ask Jamie Lee Curtis, she's sitting there in the classroom. She looks out and sees Michael Myers standing there looking at her from across the street. And then the teacher calls upon her to answer the question, and obviously that's the answer. So that's a great little thing.
Yeah, I thought you'd like that.
What I find really interesting about this next scene is Annie begins to research the apparitions. Now, I don't know what apparitions that she's researching. She's just researching the necklace that her grandmother or that her mother wore around her neck.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, Steve receives a call from the cemetery saying that obviously the grandmother's grave was desecrated. And he decides not to tell his wife. Now, that scene doesn't go anywhere. Now, I understand you're not going to go and tell your wife that, by the way, your mother's grave was desecrated.
Yeah, it's like the day after, or what, a couple of days after we bury her, I'm not going to tell her that she's been grave robbed.
Yeah, but that doesn't go anywhere.
But it does figure in later, but not in such a way that you realize this is foreshadowing.
Yeah, exactly. And there is definitely some foreshadowing in this, but
we just don't realize that it's foreshadowing.
No, we don't. Because it's not being, as I said in the last podcast, I don't want to be spoon-fed and said, you know, being told this is what you do next. But this one is, I want a little bit of why are we doing this and explain to me how we got from point A to point B. So far, we've gone from point A to D, and I don't even know what happened to B and C.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I don't understand where we're going with this part of the movie.
Yeah.
And even this part of the movie, now, Annie says to Steve that she's going to go to a movie because obviously she's still grieving her mother.
Yeah, which is where we have that scene where she talks about her brother's suicide.
Yeah, now this is where she ends up going to a grief counseling support group, which is awesome, because anyone that is you know, wants to talk to people, if they can't get the support in the family, and as I said, the dynamics between her and Steve is zero. There's no chemistry, there's no love, there's no affection, there's no nothing that I can see. So she has to go and speak to someone. So going to a support group is a great way for her to let out, you know, what's happening in her life. And I do like the fact that she does explain about the fact that her brother has a mental illness. We also find out that Annie actually discloses her mother's mental illness issues, including the dissociative identity disorder and her dementia.
Yeah.
But we're never introduced to her mother in a living presence.
No.
We don't see any of this. We don't see her.
We only know what her daughter thinks of her.
Yeah. It would have been nice to actually see the movie where the producer or the director says, okay, we're going to show you maybe 2 minutes of like a very quick
okay, to either have a scene between Annie and her mom,
yeah,
or have some flashbacks so we understand it.
Thank you. That's what I was trying to find the words for, a flashback where you can actually see that where she started to where she ended up, and you're like, oh right, so when she's talking about the identity disorder or her dementia, now we understand how she progressively got worse. We're never shown that. So we are just going by what Annie is saying, which is very, you know, which is very hard to comprehend as we go through this very confusing movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. So of course we also see that Charlie starts to see strange lights in her bedroom, but we don't really know exactly where this is going because it's never explained to us. Nope. Even at the end, it doesn't explain to us.
It's Paimon, but we don't know that.
And of course we also find out that, that Annie has a new diorama viewing that's going to be happening at a gallery, and there's a
and they're looking to get it finished, but it's like with everything that's going on, she's been having a hard time working and she's behind.
And it is really nice because, okay, this is where it's a little bit creepy. Okay, so the gallery owner is very sympathetic to what's going on, and they're actually
being very kind.
Yeah, and of course you would in this situation, and he's like saying, okay, you don't have to rush, we know you're going through things, just take your time, but we just want to know how you're going with your latest bit that you're going to be doing. Now, there's certain, you know, scenes that she's making, but she's also doing one of her mother in the hospice, basically on her deathbed.
Yeah.
Which is very, I guess that's a way of maybe working through your grief, but it's a very creepy way of doing it.
It could be, but that's the thing. That's what she does. She makes scenes from her life.
Yeah. Now, there is also two scenes that she does. There's one of her mother standing in a doorway with the light coming from behind her, and that's sort of like a very menacing sort of diorama. Yeah,
it's a little creepy. And Steve sees it and he's like, that's really creepy.
Yeah, but there's also one where you've got a diorama of what we assume to be Annie in her bed with the baby trying to breastfeed her, and her mother standing next to the bed with her breast out. It's almost like, well, you're not doing it right, so I want to show you how to do it.
Oh, I don't remember how. I don't remember that.
Yeah, that was a very weird, creepy one as well.
Yeah.
I think if your mother's standing next to your bed while you're trying to breastfeed with her, and the way the diorama came across to me is that she's there breastfeeding. You can see her breast out. You can see the baby is there, and her mother almost saying, oh, for God's sakes, give it to me. You're not doing it right.
Yeah.
And she's got her breast out ready to start suckling the baby, and it's a very weird. I mean, I know she's doing the diorama to depict her life, but
that's weird.
That was a very weird one. I didn't like that one.
All right, we ready to go to the party?
We are going to the party this time, and we are off to a party now. Peter asks his mother if he can go to a party where he hopes to see Bridget, this girl that he's got a crush on in the school, his classmate. That he's very interested in. And of course, Annie asks Peter if he's invited his sister to go with him.
Which, I'm sorry, why would he
take
a sixth grader to a high school party?
I'm sorry, this is ridiculous.
It's really inappropriate.
Now, this is something that I don't believe any person would do. Now, you're going, as you said, you're a high schooler, you're going to a high school party, high school-related people. Why would you say to your son, please take your 8, 9-year-old
sister
to the party with you?
Yeah.
She
was like 12 and he's like 15, 16.
Yeah. Now, well, he's driving age. So he's
16. That's right. He's driving. So he's at least 16, 17. He's like 16, 17.
Oh, no, he is.
He's like 12.
So he's 17.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he, okay. So he's 17. She's 13.
Yeah. Now, so it's like, I'm sorry, but no.
No, you wouldn't do that because, you know, he may be out late. And he said, you're not going to be drinking, you're not going to do any drugs, but take your sister, or at least give her the option to say no. Why would you go down that path anyway?
Yeah, that's stupid.
This annoyed me.
Now, I would like to point out that if you're paying attention, when Peter and Charlie are on their way to the party, the cult's logo can be seen carved into the pole that figures in.
Yes, you can. I remember seeing that scene because they make it such that they make it so obvious that as the car drives past, they literally hold the camera on the pole.
Yeah.
As if to say, look at that, people. We think this is going to be.
Notice this. This will be important later.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, it's a pole with some carving on it. Thank you for letting us see that. But we don't know why.
Yep.
So we see also that Charlie's got some visions of her grandmother surrounded by fire. That never comes back into play.
Nope.
And of course, you know, Charlie goes with and he forces basically Peter to take Charlie with him to the party, which it really, I don't know why you'd do that. But anyway, poor Peter has to take his little sister to the party. So, yeah, and of course, he's very flustered about having to go and monitor his sister. And of course,
basically is like, look, there's food. Go have cake. Go amuse yourself. I'm going to party with my friends.
Because he also brings some marijuana with him. And he says to one of his friends, you know, because there's this girl that he's very interested in. He goes over and she says, you invited her to the party. Yeah. And then he says, well, I've got some weed if you want to smoke. And she's like, yeah, let's go. So as he goes to go there and smoke weed, this is where Charlie comes over and says to him, well, and quite rightly so, what do I do? All these
what
kids
am I supposed to do with myself? I don't know anybody here.
Yeah, these kids are all 17. And it's like, you know, and he's like, well, just and as you said, go and eat food. There's cake. And she's like, but they're not making it for me. And he goes, no, but if you stand there, they'll give you a piece.
Yeah.
So she's like, okay, now that's foreshadowing. That's a very big foreshadowing. But, you know, this shouldn't be his responsibility, unfortunately, at this stage.
Yeah. Now, this is interesting. So the director actually anticipated that he would get criticism on why Charlie carelessly ate a nut-filled chocolate cake slice, knowing she's allergic to nuts at the party scene. Mm. He wrote the film in a way that one can interpret that Charlie is endangering herself because the demon Paimon is influencing her and trying to get her killed. Despite this, the film still received criticism on why Annie didn't make Charlie bring an EpiPen with her or why Peter wasn't more careful with Charlie at the party.
Or maybe we can put it down to the fact that he's 17, she's 13. He's trying to get with this girl. He's a high school kid. He wants to be with these people. Why is this young girl being foisted upon her brother?
Yeah, but that being said, her mother should have still made sure she had her EpiPen with her.
Yeah, but the thing is that when she hoists, you know, Charlie onto Peter to go to this party, it's not like that the mother and father are going to go and have wild butt-naked sex in the bedroom or they're going out to dinner. It was just basically, here, take your sister, get out of the house.
I don't want to deal with her right now, take her. Yeah.
And so now, it's like, okay.
Now, during the party scene, just as Peter enters the bedroom to smoke some weed, some kids are watching a black and white video on a laptop of someone being beheaded on a guillotine.
No,
foreshadowing the film's multiple beheadings.
I didn't see that one.
Yep.
Didn't see that. No, that foreshadowing didn't. Yeah, didn't.
Yep.
So we see that, of course, Charlie eats this cake that unfortunately has a substance which she's allergic to, and she begins choking. And obviously, as we know, an anaphylactic reaction happens. So Peter carries his sister to the car and rushes her towards the hospital along a dark country road. Now, as we're going along, Charlie is really in a lot of trouble. Now, she's trying to breathe. And I had an experience. I'm not digressing all the way. I had an allergic reaction at one stage where my throat felt like it was closing over. Of course, a nurse went, you're throat's not closing over, but I'm sorry, when it feels like it, it feels like it.
Yeah.
And I was trying
to get, I had that happen once too. It's terrifying.
Yeah. And I was trying to get air.
So yeah, when you can't get air and you feel like you can't breathe, it is absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. So this scene, you know, there's Peter and he's racing towards the hospital. Charlie winds down the window to try and get air, and she sticks her head out of the car window to try and get some air. And Peter's looking to see what she's doing and looks back. And unfortunately, there's an animal in the road. He swerves to miss the road, to miss the animal in the road. And he hits a utility pole, which decapitates her head violently after it hits the utility pole.
Now, this first decapitation scene is actually similar to a real life event in Marietta, Georgia that happened in 2004. A young man and his friend drove home very drunk after a party. So let this be a lesson to you, children. Do not drive drunk. The passenger felt he was going to be sick and stuck his head out the window in case he needed to throw up, while the driver accidentally swerved near a pole. The pole's guy wire decapitated the passenger. But did you know this part, hon? Because I know you knew about this. The drunk driver was so drunk, he did not realize his friend was decapitated and continued to drive home, park in his parents' driveway with his decapitated friend still in the car, and went inside to go to sleep for the night.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. So let this be a lesson to you, pitch kids.
And it wasn't until the following morning that he woke up.
They discovered the body.
Well, no, in the real life situation is that he woke up in the morning and he was covered in blood. Like he had blood everywhere. And he got up and he said, his mother said, "What the hell happened?" He said, "I don't know, but I don't know where all this blood came from." And
not mine.
He said, and of course they checked him that they retraced the steps back to the car and that's where they found the.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Steve Newburn is the special effects guy, and his team also built an animatronic puppet of the family's 13-year-old daughter, Charlie, for her decapitation by telephone pole. This scene led to the makeup team's biggest challenge in the movie. Originally, the car Charlie rode in was meant to be mounted on a track that would lead it and the animatronic puppet into the telephone pole. But changes meant that the effect had to be performed by a fully operational vehicle driving at 60 miles an hour. For the gag, a collapsible inner skull was built. This skull was meant to mirror the damage created on another Charlie head that was built to represent the aftermath of the accident. Tests were carried out in the makeup shop using a baseball bat to simulate the telephone pole's impact. Even without the planned track guiding the car, the effect went off perfectly. The driver, he nailed it the first time. Steve also said that it looked fantastic, but they only used a few frames of it because it was a little too disturbing.
Yeah, this is why I said to you, please close your eyes when this scene happens. Not the actual impact, but the scene afterwards where he drives home, parks the car, gets into bed, and we see the following day where there is a scene where her decapitated head is on the side of the road with ants all over it.
Ew.
Yeah, that's the confronting scene. So, of course, we see that.
The parents didn't know Charlie was dead until the next day when they went out and looked in the car.
When Annie goes out, because Annie was going to go out to go somewhere, and this is where Peter wakes up, and you hear, and so he doesn't really wake up. He's laying there, like, you know, in a trance, and he's laying there, and she goes out to get in the car to go somewhere, and that's where you hear Annie absolutely blood-curdling scream, and it's because that her daughter's been decapitated. And then from that scene we see a quick shot where it's on the side of the road and her head sitting there with all these bull ants all over it,
yeah,
being eaten.
Yeah.
So of course the family then hold a funeral for Charlie, and the blood-curdling screams that Annie's letting out is just you can understand it. And of course, Steve, the husband, looks through Charlie's sketchbook of drawings. I like it. It's sort of like foreshadowing where the last picture is of her grandmother, and then there's no pictures after that. So it's almost like that was the last picture that she ever drew, which is one of her grandmother. So he thinks that there's something significant.
And the fact of that sketchbook is foreshadowing as well.
Yeah, it'll certainly come back into play. Of course, Peter starts experiencing panic attacks and smokes marijuana, trying to alleviate the guilt that he's got. Of course, Annie grieves alone while sitting in the car in her driveway. She's not going to really be engaging. And this is where it's like everyone seems to break off into their own little group. You've got Steve in one area coping with his grief. You got Peter trying to cope with his and trying to be, you know, understand what
and
happened.
And his guilt that he was the one who did this.
And he's now, you know, trying to deal with her. So it really, you know, it does happen to just go all over the place, unfortunately. So Annie drives herself to the support group meeting, but decides to turn around while still in the parking lot. And of course, Annie, you know, when she parks the car and then she decides, listen, I'm going to just drive out. And there's a fellow group member called Joan, and she spots Annie and stops to talk to her. And she hears about Charlie's death. And Joan basically confides in Annie about the loss of her own child and her grandson. Yep. So she's got a double amount of grief that she's going through. So it's sort of like we're starting to build on what's gone on in Annie's life. So, you know, Annie returns home. Steve tries to maybe get some sort of alone time with her, but Annie rebuffs him. And of course, as I said to you, there is no chemistry. So
him
being rebuffed by Annie, it didn't surprise me at all.
No.
And Annie basically starts sleeping in,
the treehouse.
In the treehouse. She's basically
She brings up heaters and puts them in the treehouse.
Yeah, she's dissociated herself from her family. She wants to be alone. She doesn't want to go anywhere near the family. She's trying to process her own grief. I understand that. So Peter's asleep in his bedroom, and of course he hears what he thinks is this clicking noise that Charlie used to make, and sees what he thinks is a vision of his dead sister in the room. But it appears to be his hoodie in the corner. So that really doesn't go anywhere. You can see that it's like something's going to happen. And yeah, nothing happens. Okay. Yeah. It doesn't, you know. So Annie visits Joan's apartment. Just obviously, as a, you know, she's another lady. So she wants to try and get some support from her. And Annie tells Joan about a sleepwalking incident where she doused Peter and Charlie and herself from head to toe in paint thinner before going to light the match. Now, this doesn't even come into play because we don't know why she got to that point. Yes, she was sleepwalking, but how many of us go into the tool shed and grab paint thinner and douse our family in it?
And if you've ever smelled paint thinner, it'll wake you up.
Yeah. So is everyone that asleep that no one actually worked out that you're getting doused with paint thinner? But it doesn't go anywhere, right? Unfortunately, it doesn't, you know.
Yeah, that still had no relation to anything else.
Yeah. Now, from her body language, Annie implies that the matches were in her left hand and a can of paint thinner in her right. And Annie explains that the relationship between her children and her have never been the same afterwards. Well, you think? Because... I don't think that he's going to sit there and go, oh, you know. I seem to be going quick through the movie, but this is how quick the changing scenes are.
That's okay, because we don't want to drag this out. No. It was painful enough to watch.
Yeah, so Steve, you know, finds... Now, this is a really disturbing scene. I don't like this scene because it's really weird. And I understand that people, you know, they do deal with grief in their own way, but Steve comes up to Annie's workshop to see that she is constructing a diorama of the scene where Charlie died.
She was decapitated. So you see her little head on the thing. You got the pole. You got the car.
You got
her body leaning out of the car.
And of course, the only thing that Steve can say is, do not let Peter see this.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, what the mother hell are you doing?
Well, not just that, but at no time has he said to her, are you okay? How can I help you? I love you.
Because there's no chemistry between the actors.
I know that.
Yeah. So you wouldn't get that, unfortunately.
But you see her so intensely grieving, even after just her mother died, you don't see him having any kind of empathy toward her.
No. And this is the whole thing, is if she is going to be doing this diorama, showing at the gallery, I think this would be very, very disturbing if you go and look at this and say, oh, look, that's the depiction of her daughter getting
my daughter dying.
It's like, what the hell? I mean, there's places for that. That's not in this. I mean, maybe if she's working.
Well, I don't think she was in. See, and that's the thing.
I hope she's not
going to include it. Working on the stuff for the gallery. She was just working on stuff that was processing her own emotions.
I hope she would not be showing that, because that would be extremely disturbing.
No.
So now we see that Steve and Annie and Peter are having a very, very awkward dinner. And of course, this is where Annie blames her son for Charlie's death. and they really start going at it.
And he rightly points out that if she hadn't have forced him to take Charlie with him, she'd still be home.
Exactly.
Which is completely
correct. That is true. You got me to take her. And as he says to her, you got me to take her. She didn't even want to go.
Yeah. She was perfectly happy being home drawing, but no, you had to make me take her.
See, that's the whole thing. Like, Charlie was self-sufficient. She was happy just to be in her room drawing and enjoying her time
alone. Doing her own thing, yeah.
So you getting her to go to a party and she died, guess what? Not my fault. You would have had your daughter if you didn't give me to her.
I mean, his fault driving under the influence of drugs, but that's another thing.
But also the fact is that even though that he had been doing that, it was the animal in the road that got him to swerve the car.
Yeah. So, but even so, he didn't even notice anything happened to his sister. And
So now there's a sort of like a subplot here, and we're going to just skip over this because it just doesn't really matter. Where Joan is at a supply store, and Annie's at a supply store because she's going to buy some more stuff. And she basically Joan tells Annie that she went to a seance and she was a skeptic, but now she's suddenly been shown that because she's suddenly a medium that she can contact her dead grandson Lewis.
So she gets Annie to come over to her house and she shows her how it works and she gives her the tools to be able to do it. And by the way, the language that's spoken during the invocation that she gives to Annie is a combination of Hebrew and Enochian, just in case you're interested.
Okay. So I like it how, after this whole thing of where Annie actually witnesses what Joan was saying and what was happening, that Annie decides that she's going to go home and do it, but she's going to wake up her family at 2:45 in the goddamn morning. And she drags the son.
I think we actually skipped the bit where Peter saw the light in his classroom.
No, that's coming up.
No, because it's before she does the seance with
So there's a light that actually happens to permeate through certain parts of the movie that we don't understand why.
Later to understand is the demon.
Yeah, but it's basically just a square light that goes. So if you can think of a hallway, think of light on the top, the bottom, and both the sides that goes towards a door and just disappears into the door.
Yep.
That's all the light is.
Now, what happens is Peter is sitting in class, bored out of his mind, and he sees this light and it startles him. And everybody just kind of looks at him like, whatever. And then he ends up with his hand like up and it's doing weird things.
It's like he's having a stroke, doesn't it?
Yeah. Or a seizure of some sort. And they're like, what's going on? And then all of a sudden, he just slams his face into the desk
and breaks his nose.
Yeah. And then they take him, they goes to the nurse, they take him, parents come, take him home, whatever.
Yeah.
But in an interview, Alex Wolff, who played Peter, explains that he wanted to actually break his own nose for the scene where his character slams his head into the desk. The director respectfully declined.
Thank you.
And told him they'd give him a soft cushion desk for the scene. When it was time for the scene to be shot, Wolf slams his head into the desk only to discover that the top was foam and the bottom was hard. He actually ended up dislocating his jaw, which is a previous injury that he had. So it like re-dislocated his jaw for the scene.
I mean, I like method actors, but
that's taking it a little far to break his own nose.
That's a little too far, mate. And sorry.
Because that is so effing painful.
Yeah. And I'm sorry. Break your nose for a movie that actually.
And if the scene didn't take on the first scene, what are you going to do?
Exactly. And if you're going to do it in a movie that actually makes sense and is good.
Yeah, that's actually worth sacrificing.
Don't when you're age 70 and you can't breathe out of your nose, say, yeah, I broke my nose in a stupid movie that I did that I thought was going to be awesome, but it was a pile of crap.
Yeah.
So I like how, Joan has shown Annie how to, contact the spirits. And she manages to bring her poor family down to the living room. And really, Peter's not interested in this. Steve is definitely not into this whole thing.
Yeah.
But she's trying to explain that this is what happened, and this is that, you know, that Charlie is here, that we can contact Charlie, that, you know, she will draw something on this chalkboard, yep, that, you know, she'd done it before, and this is what she got the response. And, you know, Peter is like, you know, Dad, I don't want to do this. Dad, please.
Yeah, just make her stop.
Yeah. And, you know, Annie is really pushing this onto the family, so much so that at this stage, I said to you, if I was Peter, if I was Steve, I'd be like saying, okay, divorce court is coming up. I'm taking this child because you're endangering this poor kid. You are mentally screwing him up.
Yeah. Now, so, I'd like to point out, now this is actually kind of a fun little trivia. To make the chalkboard write on itself, the special effects team put a magnet in the chalk and a magnet on the other side of the chalkboard so they could make the chalk move without anybody touching it. It was difficult to get a small magnet inside the chalk and to make it write smoothly. Ironically, the same technique was used in the film version of Matilda, and Millie Shapiro, who plays Charlie, starred as Matilda in the Broadway musical.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I thought that one was kind of fun.
That's good, that one. Now, I like it when she's doing, you know, this whole seance claiming that she's summoned Charlie. Annie, you know, seems to be possessed. Suddenly, Charlie seems to possess Annie. And Steve snaps Annie out of a trance by dousing her with water as Peter is absolutely losing his mind because, you know, she even takes on the mannerism of the clicking sound that only Charlie does.
Yeah.
And with all. With
oh, that, yeah. Because that, so it was almost like she was being possessed temporarily. Yeah,
between that and all the noises going around the house, it's like, you know, it became too real for Peter.
And what we didn't realize at that point, though, is that the clicking noise is Paimon.
Yeah.
And it must have and took her over temporarily. Now, throughout the film, several words can be seen scrawled on the walls. At one point, there are two words, Liftoch Pandemonium. And Liftoch is an English transliteration of the Hebrew word to open. Pandemonium is Latin for all demons and is what Satan names hell in John Milton's Paradise Lost.
Oh, now that's an interesting bit because very few people would know that one.
Yeah. And in one of the scenes in Peter's classroom, the teacher is talking about the sacrifice of Iphigenia, Agamemnon's daughter. Both Iphigenia and Charlie are the daughters of those who were sacrificed in hopes of bringing forth a great event, one being victory against the Trojans and the other the bringing forth of Paimon.
Oh. Now, as we're getting closer to the end of this movie, which thank God. We are. So Charlie's spirit starts to draw in her old sketchbook. And of course, Peter sees a vision of his dead sister in the corner and her head falls off, turning it into a ball. And then all of a sudden, Peter is choked on his bed. And of course, Peter accuses his mother of sleepwalking and attacking him again. And this is where Annie says to Peter, don't tell your father what's happening. And Annie goes on to explain that something supernatural is happening in the house and she's the only one that can stop it. Now, as I said to you in the last movie that we did, you know, do not play with Ouija boards. You can open doorways that you cannot close. I stupidly have played with Ouija boards. Yeah, but I can actually close the doors, but I'm not experienced enough to believe that I've closed every door.
Yeah, you just don't know.
You don't know. So don't play with Ouija boards because you don't know what's going to happen. But there is Annie going, well, I'm the only one that can stop it. Well, you've opened up a door, sweetie. Now you're in deep shit right now.
Yeah.
Of course, the window above Peter's bed has a mark that looks similar to the one in Charlie's classroom when it was struck by the bird. Now, I didn't put two and two together on this one because it didn't seem that it was actually relevant. And it really, in all honesty, it really doesn't. Isn't really that relevant. But of course, this is where Annie realizes that the spirit that she summoned is actually malevolent.
Yes, and not her daughter.
No, it's not her daughter. So Annie grabs her sketchbook, her Charlie's sketchbook, and throws it in the fireplace. And of course, it's at this stage that Annie's watching it burning and it's not burning. And then all of a sudden we see that Annie's arm mirrors the burning book by also catching on fire. So, you know, Annie, and of course, she's also drugged her husband too. Like she put something in Steve's water to knock him out. Because at this stage, poor old Steve is laying on the couch because he's had it with laying in the bedroom. He doesn't want to be anywhere near Annie. Yeah. So this book is burning in front of him. He's asleep. She's trying to grab the book out. Her arm is burning. So she's trying to put that out. So I was like, it just doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, I don't know.
It doesn't. So, of course, you know, Annie then returns to Joan for help, but no one's there. And she decides to go into Joan's residence. Well, it's break and entering. Why not? And the camera shows us Joan's place is decked out in witchcraft paraphernalia, including a photo of Peter inside a ceremonial triangle and a symbol of that Annie recognizes from her family photo. So now she's starting to put two and two together that Joan doesn't seem to be all that she's saying.
No. Well, because she sees she runs back home and she looks in the photo album at that picture of the group, and she finds Joan in the picture with her mother wearing the same pendant.
Yes.
And that symbol that is shown throughout the film, the cult symbol,
yep,
particularly on the necklace that Annie and her mother wear, is a slightly different version of the real seal of the demon Paimon, as shown in old texts of demonology. Paimon is a real demon. The most noticeable difference is that the real symbol has four figures instead of the film's three. The symbol was changed for the film because it's considered bad luck to use real demonic religious symbolism in films. And films who have used real demonic religious symbols, things like The Exorcist, The Omen, and Rosemary's Baby, have infamously been plagued by accidents and hardship.
Yes, they have. Anyone wants to know more about that, read up on what happened on the set of The Exorcist.
We talk about that when we covered that?
I believe we did.
Yeah,
the amount of problems that they actually had. And they even had to get a Roman Catholic priest to come in and bless the set every time they shot, just to try and keep what they were doing at bay. So there was a lot of dramas that was going on. And that, as I said, you know, that's something you just don't want to deal with and don't want to bring through. So we do see that Annie discovers her mother's headless corpse in their house's attic, which just happens to be over the bed, right over the where Peter is sleeping. So because we the way that she finds out is that she starts to see she hears this noise in the attic. So she opens up the attic and there's all these flies and everything that comes out.
Oh, it was disgusting.
So she goes up into the attic. She's got her torch and she looks through and we see that
the torch being a flashlight for those in America.
A torch or a flashlight. And we see that she looks over into the corner and there's her mother's decapitated body laying up there.
Did we ever find out what happened to her mother's head?
No, it's never explained.
Yeah.
So Peter hears Joan shouting because he's in the
but it's also school. Interesting that the mother is as decomposed as she is because she's only it hasn't been that long.
No, it hasn't.
And if they used embalming on her, which they do in the United States, she would still be in pretty good shape. She wouldn't be as icky.
It looks like they've dug her up maybe a year later. Maybe even 6 months later she would have been, but she looks like, because they've only just dug her up and it seems to be that she's only been in the ground maybe a week, if that.
I was going to say I only think it's been maybe 6 weeks tops.
Yeah,
and if she's been embalmed, she actually wouldn't be that bad.
Yeah, so she looks pretty messed up.
Yeah.
So obviously, as we've said, that you know Peter is at school and he's completely just checked out. He's just not there, and we're seeing that Joan is shouting from across the fence that she's saying, "I expel you." Towards Peter. And of course, this is, as you said,
she's trying to get him out of his body so Paimon can come in.
Yeah. And this is where, obviously, as we know, that Peter manages to break his nose in the school, which doesn't make, yeah. I don't know. So Annie, you know, once again, you know, there's a lot of parts of this movie that I don't want to go into because they're just not even interesting.
Yeah. Let's not even.
Yeah.
Let's just.
So we're getting towards the end of the movie. And of course, we see that. And he's trying to explain to Steve about the connection between Charlie's sketchbook and what's going on in the house. And of course, and saying that Steve needs to destroy it in order to save Peter. But she said that she tried to throw the book into the fire, but she caught fire herself.
Yeah.
So she figures, well, if you throw the book into the fire, then I will still catch fire. I'm going to, you know,
I'll sacrifice myself.
I'm going to sacrifice myself to save Peter. Now, yeah. She basically says to Steve, I can't do it alone. Now, at this stage, Steve is just lost completely. He's like, okay, if you want me to do this, I've had enough of this. I can't do this anymore. But she's like, please, please, please throw this book into the fire. So it's like, okay, All right, that's fine. But before that, before we get to this point, Steve accuses Annie of digging up Ellen's grave because, as Steve says, you know, as Annie says to Steve, up there, up in the attic, is my dead mother. She's got no head. She's yep. laying on the ground. And please go up and see. I just want to make sure that I'm not seeing this because there's so much stuff going around the house. So Steve goes up and then comes back down. And this is where he accuses her of digging up the grave. And he says, you know, this is what happened. Your mother's grave was desecrated. You dug her up. You did that. You brought all this stuff onto the family. And so Annie's really, you know, not interested in this whole thing. And she's like, I didn't do this. This is what happened to the book. I tried to burn it. I want you to burn it for me. I'm going to sacrifice myself to save Peter. And he's like, okay, yep, I'll do it. He throws the book into the fire. Presumably we think that she's going to spontaneously combust.
And he goes, Steve, whoosh.
Steve spontaneously combusts. So
like a whole body flames.
Oh, he is in flames and a half.
Now, as I recall, though, it's almost like it hit him so fast that he was gone before he knew it hit him, because I don't remember him screaming or writhing in pain at all.
No, it was almost like a flamethrower.
Yeah.
He just whooshed and he was gone.
Yeah. And there was just no reaction from him, which seemed rather odd.
Yeah. So now we see that Annie is completely possessed, which we don't know why, but she's suddenly possessed. We don't know.
Somehow she's now possessed.
And she's now standing in the corner of Peter's bedroom against the wall, but when I say above you, she's literally standing. She's like in the corner above ceiling height, watching.
Okay. So she's doing a bit of a conjuring demon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Peter's searching the house. Peter leaves his room because there's a ladder to the attic, which is withdrawn. And of course, so Peter finds his father's charred corpse on the ground. And of course, then Annie chases Peter around the house towards the attic, which is exactly where she wants him to go.
Yep.
And of course, the ladder to the attic is now down, and Annie jumps up and ferociously pounds her head on the attic door after Peter climbs the ladder and retracts it into the upstairs ceiling. She is banging the shit out. She is headbutting the thing, which is like, okay, is that supposed to be scary? It's just annoying. Really.
Yeah, it was just creepy.
Of course, in the attic, Peter finds flies, candles, and a photo of his face with the eyes punched out. And of course, Ellen's body is now gone. So all you can see is like the outline of, like, you know, where her
his photo with the eyes punched out was in the middle of like either that symbol or an upside down pentacle or something.
Yeah, similar to that. Yeah. So Annie suddenly hovers above Peter before severing her own head, because you're hearing this cutting thing and you don't know where this noise is coming from until Peter looks up and you see that she's literally hovering above him and she's got piano
decapitating herself.
Yeah, and she's got piano wire, and you know, because the camera says, hey, everyone, there's a wire missing in their piano.
Yeah, there's a dismantled or destroyed piano, and so that tells you that she has the piano wire from that.
Yeah, and you're hearing her cutting her own head off. So, you know, we also see that he looks over and he sees three undressed devil worshippers standing there in the corner looking at him. So,
and why they're naked, I have no idea.
Don't know why. Peter jumps out the window, which I would do too, but and of course he hits the ground below, which knocks him out. And of course, Peter rises after a very oddly glowing light is seen previously hovers around his body. And of course, Peter follows.
Yeah, because I mean, but actually jumping from like a second floor, second, third floor, obviously that would have killed him.
Yes, it would have. He landed on the ground pretty bloody hard. So.
Yeah, so it opened the door for Paimon to take over the body.
Yeah. So Peter's like gets up and he's very drowsy, but he's watching his mother's headless corpse float into the treehouse. And it's like, yep, okay, we don't really see that very often. So we see that Peter goes.
I think I actually looked at you and said, well, that's not something you see every day.
You don't. Because we see that Peter goes inside the treehouse, and of course we see an assembly of the devil worshippers in various states of undress greeting Peter as he walks in. And there's one woman with long hair in a bathrobe, and Charlie's decapitated head sits atop a statue of Paimon, which...
Totally missed that.
Well, I looked at it and I'm like, is that Charlie's head?
I totally missed that that was Charlie.
Yeah, I because it doesn't look like Charlie's
head. But it makes sense, because that's where Paimon had resided.
Yeah. So Peter looks around with a daze and a very flat expression, and we're showing Annie and Ellen's headless bodies lie there. They're on the ground,
side by
basically
side,
bowing on the floor in front of the statue. Of course, then Joan's voice calls Peter Charlie, as a woman crowns him but welcomes Peter as Paimon, while the coven basically hails the demon's arrival. The story ends with a shot of a model treehouse filled with dolls that look like Peter, the coven, and the headless Annie and Ellen. And then we hear a clicking sound.
Yep.
And that's the end of the movie.
Like I said,
now, on a
scale, boring doesn't make sense. Don't bother.
On a scale of 0 to 5 movie reels, 0 being how do I get the last 120 minutes of my life? But, oh, you're not? No, I do want to do the score. Yeah. Let's do your stuff first.
Because yeah, then we wrap up and
we'll do the story. Okay, so you okay. Do yours.
So there are 4 things more that I want to share with you.
Okay, cool.
So at one point, Peter is under the bleachers. And one of Peter's friends with him under the bleachers can be seen at the end of the film as one of the town's secret cultists. When they're smoking at school, he's the one with the man bun and the hoodie.
Yep.
And when the camera is slowly following Peter's feet in the treehouse, it pans over the kneeling cultists. And the closest one in the frame is the man bun still intact.
Oh, okay. So he was making sure that this was all going to.
Yeah, he was keeping him where he wanted to be.
Keeping on him, yeah.
Now, in the opening shot, a life rune, which basically looks like an upside-down peace sign, can be seen constructed into the side of the treehouse. The life rune symbolizes birth and beginnings. The appearance of the life rune signifies the beginning of the story and foreshadows the treehouse as the location of Paimon's rebirth. At around an hour 54, a death rune, which is a right side up peace sign, can be seen constructed into the corner of the attic wall. The death rune symbolizes death and endings, and the appearance of the rune signifies the end of the story.
Oh, yeah, because it comes in full circle.
Exactly. Now, Hereditary's advertising campaign has been credited for keeping Charlie's death a secret from viewers, notably showing Millie Shapiro prominently in the trailer, even though Charlie is alive for only a quarter of the film. This deliberate, and it says a lot about this film and how bad it is that I honestly didn't care, that I was actually happy when Charlie got killed because she was so annoying.
Yep.
This deliberate mislead is similar to the horror classic Psycho back in 1960, where Janet Leigh was made to look like the star of the film, only to be murdered a third of the way through.
Now I get it, yeah.
Now, I promised you a piece of trivia that was just going to knock your socks off.
All right, knock them off, baby.
This movie, Hereditary, is included by Stephen Schneider in his list, 1001 movies you must see before you die.
All I can say, I can't find any words.
I know. That's rather a stunning piece of trivia, isn't it?
This could be put into the 1001 movies you don't have to see before you die.
That you don't want to waste your life
on. You don't want to waste your life on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I very rarely do I rip a movie to shreds, but I'm doing it because this is, I don't know what movie everyone else saw, but this is utter garbage.
Yeah.
And that is a very interesting bit of trivia that will lead us into the very last part, which is on a scale of 0 to 5 movie reels, 0 being how do I get the last 126 minutes of my life back, to 5 it was perfect and I'd watch it all over again. What would your score be?
0.
Me too. And that is saying something considering that we actually gave Birdemic higher than Hereditary.
That's only because back then you wouldn't let me give it a 0. You made me give it a 1.
Yeah, well, this is a 0. Now, everyone, if you want to, and I'm not going to challenge you on your beliefs. If you believe it's a great movie.
But if you do like it, we would love to hear why.
I would really love to hear why it is that you guys like it. So because this movie is showing up on 2 podcasts, it's being shown on the Horror Crypt podcast and this one, I'd like to find out if you want to let me know, horrorcrypt2022@gmail.com. And this one at hello@homeclassmoviechat.com. Please email me. I would love to hear your opinions of this movie and just tell me exactly what it is about this movie that you like and what maybe I have missed something that I just...
Yeah, what
just,
did we miss?
What did we miss?
Everybody else seems to see.
Because I have heard nothing but rave reviews and I got to the point where it's like, I had seen this movie. I didn't like it to begin with, but then I was listening to other podcasts who were absolutely raving about this movie, and I'm like, I have to see this movie again. And I literally, I checked the trailer. I looked at the header of this movie. I am watching the right movie. People are saying it is with Toni Collette. It is with Gabrielle Byrne. It is about this movie. So I know that this is the movie we're watching, but I cannot see what people have seen in this movie. So I am giving it a zero. Kat's giving it a zero. All I can say is this wasted my time and my life. And on my other podcast, The Horror Crypt, I always say, I watch these movies so you don't have to. If you want to go and see it, or if you've already seen it, more power to you. But this is one movie that I will never, ever
watch again. I will never waste the time to watch this.
I'd never watch this movie again. I would not buy it. I would not rent it. I would not download it. No.
Okay. Now, that being said, we love that you come along for the ride with us in the discussion of these movies.
Absolutely.
And if you have been enjoying the podcast, if you haven't already, please give us a like and a review wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have other friends or family who enjoy movies, please feel free to share the podcast, because we love sharing these conversations with you.
Absolutely. We really love that you guys keep coming back week after week listening to us.
Absolutely.
Prattling about movies. So we are very pleased that you guys come back to listen to us. So
yes we do. So thank you for joining us for Hereditary. We hope you found this more interesting than the movie.
More interesting than we did.
And we will see you next time, and in the meantime, see you at the movies.
Bye everyone.